Hey everybody, it is Justin Shackle welcoming you to episode 25 of Toeing the Slab Pitching with David Cohn. It is the place for pitching every single week, and we do it with the five-time World Series champion, the Cy Young Award winner David Cohn, the research extraordinaire James Smythe, and myself. And guys, look, the exhibition games have begun, the big free agent signings, the trades, they've occurred, and well, we have a guest on with us this week that if you are a Cubs fan or a Yankee fan or are really interested in what goes into modern coaching, game preparation, I think you are going to eat everything up from what Mike Borzello had to say. What do you think, David?
Yes, there's a timeline that coincides with his career that kind of explains the changes in the game, especially the dynamic of analytics, each team has their own personal database, their proprietary information that they've built, and they guard it with great secrecy, state secrets. You know, they God forbid that you give out any details on proprietary held data information, but Mike Borzello has a great understanding of that. He's educated himself along the way through the BAT system that was originally kind of the league-wide database system to now what he described as the Ivy system that they developed in Chicago with the Cubs. So really interesting take by a guy who's been around a lot, been around some winning teams, couple World Series championship teams, and really understands the dynamic of the changes in the game over the last 20 years.
And Mike has 5 World Series rings. He was the bullpen catcher for the Yankees during their late 90s run. He spent some time with the Dodgers as well, and then spent about a decade with the Cubs in various roles. I mean, he was a catching strategist and an associate pitching strategist. He really prepped the pitchers in Wrigleyville for each game, highlighted by that 2016 run to end the curse with that World Series championship. And James, I thought you brought up a really good point, and it was so fun to listen to Mike's insight about the pressures of that 2016 team actually getting the job done, because they were clearly viewed as one of the teams to beat in 2016. They had to deal with that pressure of maybe being a World Series favorite, and they were able to get it done. And Mike's insight there was pretty cool.
Right. And it was interesting to hear him talk about how even within the team, there was that pressure. And even when things started to turn south in Game 7, you know, here we go again, and things like that, how that kind of narrative takes hold. But you mentioned all the different hats that he wore with the Cubs: catching coach, strategy coach, assistant, associate pitching coach. I think Kyle Hendricks had the best name for him: secret weapon.
Yeah. So his career kind of blends through eras, like you were saying, David, and some of the other things that we discussed with Mike, how he was catching Mariano Rivera when Mo discovered his cutter at the old Tiger Stadium. Also talking about coaching, advising different pitchers and their personalities, having to manage that, how he prepares for pitchers for a full series in the age of information where we're at now. And yeah, he touched on the Ivy database system with us when in his time with the Cubs. You just think about some of the pitchers that he's worked with. I mean, David Cohn, Mariano Rivera, Roger Clemens, Andy Pettit, Randy Johnson, with the Dodgers, Clayton Kershaw, Kenley Jansen, and then Lackey, Lester, Hendricks, Arrieta with the Cubs. He has had a remarkable coaching run, and the evolution of his coaching game has really evolved. So we really, I hate speaking in hyperbole, being like, man, you guys are going to love this interview, but this was super enjoyable and one of the best, in my opinion, on Toeing the Slab. All right, let's begin with the opener here this week. And guys, this was deemed as the offseason of the shortstop. It was a historic free agent class for shortstops, and the big guns are now all off the board. Trevor Story was the last one on Sunday, agreeing to a 6-year deal with the Red Sox, $140 million. And ironically, it looks like he's going to be playing second base to form a pretty lethal double play combination with Xander Bogaerts over at Fenway Park. If you do the math, there is over $880 million combined between the money that Story, Seager, Baez, Semien, and Correa raked in free agency. And I think the cool part is that teams like the Twins, the Tigers, the Rangers, obviously you have the Red Sox, but my point is some of the big blue bloods in the sport didn't really get involved, and you're seeing different teams acquire star players.
So true and well put, Shaq. And that is going to be the narrative moving forward. The Yankees needed a shortstop and they chose to sit out this one, and not only sit it out, but you know, I worry that maybe they put some pressure on their young prospects, and that's not fair in my mind. Anthony Volpe has no bearing on the front office decision-making process. He's going to develop at his own pace, and certainly Peraza as well, and some of the other shortstop prospects in the Yankee organization that moving forward that are going to at some point be asked to fill that spot. So it's going to be interesting, fair or not. This front office is going to be judged on that, this decision-making during this historical free agency, where there was, you know, maybe the best free agent shortstop class of all time that were all available all at once. So yes, moving forward, it's going to be interesting to follow this and see how it plays out. The Yankees made their decisions. They made their trade. They're not done. Maybe they had some pitching before it's over, but I thought it was interesting that both DJ LeMahieu and Aaron Judge expressed concern or dismay about Trevor Story's recent signing with the Red Sox, and for obvious reasons, because the Red Sox are the Red Sox, and the Yankees and Red Sox make up maybe the greatest sports rivalry of all time. So it's going to be another follow that Trevor Story is now in the American League East, and the American League East is a beast, to say the least, right now.
Well, it's kind of a double whammy, right? Because Story, you have an opportunity at shortstop to add, you know, a few wins at the shortstop position where the Yankees had a hole going into the offseason. And so not only do you not make a big splash, whether it's Correa, Story, Seager, whatever, now you're transferring wins from that could have gone to your team. Now they're going to your biggest rival. So they kind of dodged a bullet with Freddie Freeman in that same spot, because he ended up going to the Dodgers. The rumors were that the Yankees, the Red Sox, the Blue Jays, even the Rays were in the mix on Freddie. The Yankees got lucky there that he went to the Dodgers. So it's not the double hit where you're now swinging multiple wins going the other way. Now with Story going to second base in Boston, that could be a real swing in the AL East race, because everyone thinks that it's going to be pretty tight. Rays, Blue Jays, Red Sox, Yankees, a couple wins this way, a couple wins that way can really swing the division race. And one interesting thing with Story, a little parallel with Semien, is that here's a guy who was a great shortstop and he slides over to second base. Semien handled it great. And I think Story's going to have a big year in Boston too.
There is some trepidation about Story's arm, how it would hold up at shortstop. The Red Sox have him now, presumably at second base, but it's also a pretty good insurance policy in the event that Xander Bogaerts does opt out of his contract at the end of this season. It's possibly looking that it's going to be the likely scenario, given the type of cash that we've seen thrown towards some free agent shortstops this offseason. So it's a very good insurance policy. And we, you know, some of the John Boy media crew, they were out at the Topps Funhouse in Arizona last week. And when this free agent fever was hitting, the trades were going down, I was saying to people, man, I'm wary of the Red Sox making a big move. They're kind of in the weeds here, whether it would be James, like you mentioned, Freddie Freeman, maybe possibly even trading for Matt Olson, shoring up the first base position there, but also getting in on the Correas or the Stories. It turns out it's Trevor Story. But with Carlos Correa going to the Twins, I know we're focusing here on the AL East. I think we've covered it. Guys, I've been pretty down on the AL Central in years past. This is a fascinating division heading into 2022, in my opinion.
Well, it's a great point. And coming off of a new collective bargaining agreement that was just negotiated, and a lot of talk about anti-competitive behavior or tanking, or our teams, you know, putting their best foot forward. It's good for the sport that Minnesota put their best foot forward, even though they did some maneuvering and made a trade with the Yankees and freed up some of Donaldson's money. This was a team that kind of cratered last year. And at the trade deadline, they made some big trades and it looked like they were in a rebuilding mode, but no, they retooled in a hurry. That's good for the sport overall. You know, if you're a Yankee fan, maybe you're not so happy with that, but you know, Correa with the Twins is good for the sport overall. And I'm happy for Minnesota. I'm happy for the Twins fans. They deserve it. It's a great ballpark. It's a great city. It's going to be interesting to see how this Minnesota Twins team plays this year. Most of the projections say they're still falling a little bit short, but you can't fault the effort, you know, to go that extra mile and sign Correa to that type of in, ingenious contract says a lot about their purpose right now.
It's a fantastic short-term, low-risk signing, three-year deal for Correa. And chances are, if Correa comes out and stays healthy or has a normal Correa season, he's going to opt out next winter, and he'll get another bite at the apple in free agency, and we might all be right back here talking about another great shortstop hitting free agency. I don't know if this is quite enough to get them right there with the White Sox, but it's close enough where this at least puts them back into playoff contention. And even the Tigers are an interesting team. Again, maybe they're not quite ready to make the leap and contend for a division title, but they were flirting with 500 for some time last year. And they look like they made some additions with Eduardo Rodriguez and Javier Baez. Maybe they can take another step and make the Central a little more competitive.
I'm giving love to the Royals too. I mean, they have that young core. They traded for Amir Garrett. They signed Zach Greinke. They're going to have some good veteran leadership to kind of shepherd the young guns that they have in the rotation that they hope pan out. So I don't think there's going to be too many pushovers in the AL Central like we've seen in recent years past. I was going to get to Mike Borzello, but I wanted to ask you this, David, because James brought up the short-term contract and the opportunity that was kind of presented to the Twins with Carlos Correa. A lot of people are saying, hey, any team could have done that deal with Carlos Correa. Why didn't they? Do you think that opportunity would have been realistic for any team?
It's still a very high average annual value. It's still, depending on each individual team's budget, you're adding $35 million to even on a one-year basis to the top line. So, you know, that varies from team to team, but it just shows you the nature of pre-lockout and post-lockout. Pre-lockout, Seager gets $300+ million, $325 million, just to sign in Texas. Simeon too. They moved quickly, and then after the lockout, we talked about it here on Toe in the Slab that when things are rushed, sometimes mistakes can be made on both the player side, the agent side, and front office side. So it remains to be seen. It's hard to say, you know, at the end of the day, which teams could have taken it, which teams, you know, couldn't have fit it in. I would say the vast majority of teams could have fit that in if they think that he's the type of guy that can push you right over the edge and become a contender. And he is that good. I think his numbers speaks for themselves. And he is a game changer without a doubt, a 27-year-old, probably the best shortstop in the game right now. That's going to make a difference on anybody's team. So plus $35 million on the top line. Yeah. There's a lot of large market teams that could have done that.
Speaking of changing the game, we were able to talk to one of the guys that pretty much transcended or had a heavy hand in transcending the Cubs organization from a last place club to breaking the curse and winning the World Series in 1996. There was a whole lot that preceded that. Borzello was there when, like we mentioned, Mo refined his cutter in 96. He was there preparing the pitching staff of the last dynasty that we've seen in baseball. He worked with young stars in LA like Clayton Kershaw, like Kenley Jansen, and part of turning the Cubs into champions with John Lester, Kyle Hendricks, Jake Arrieta, working under Theo Epstein. Whole lot of insight coming up here with our guest this week on Toe in the Slab, Pitching with David Cohn. It is Mike Borzello. Mike, thanks so much for joining us on this week's episode. And look, let's break the ice with what we all want to know here right out of the bat. What is your best David Cohn story? And just to set the bar for you here, we had your godfather, Joe Torre, on, and he talked about David throwing an ashtray against his Mickey Mantle pitcher in the manager's office at Old Yankee Stadium while smoking a cigarette after a bad outing. So if you can establish a new watermark for us here, by all means, the floor is yours.
Coney, where can I go with this?
I know, right? The problem is we can't really tell the truth now, can we?
Right. I have three or four on the top of my head, but if we're just talking about at the field, it's more of the meeting we had, Coney, in Seattle. Do you remember? We had
yes, very much. Yes.
You guys had, prior to me getting there, you guys had lost in 95 and in a tough series to the Mariners. And Mariners seemed to always find a way to beat the Yankees, and it hadn't changed even once I got there. I mean, somehow it didn't matter if we were up 3 in the 9th, it seemed like they found a way to beat us. And there was one game where they were beating us by like 10, and one of their young kids scored a run and over celebrated at that point of the game, and it really rubbed it in our faces. And we had a meeting after the game that Joe Torre called, and Coney took the center stage on it. And it was, I mean, it grabbed everybody's attention. And I don't know our record after that versus Seattle, but everyone took what he said to heart. It was early on in my career, so I was like, wow. And to this day, I've never seen a starting pitcher kind of be the leader of a team. And that was really, really something that stayed with me. And I'm sure everyone who was in that room remembers that speech. And Coney, you said, I remember the one line was, "Hey, I left a vein on that mound." Do you remember saying that?
Yes, I do. Yeah, it was the beginning of my aneurysm. Yeah,
we're not going to put up with this anymore. This guy's celebrating right in front of our dugout. And I mean, it really motivated us going forward. That's my number one at the field David Cone story.
All right, we'll keep it in the ballpark for sure.
Right. Right.
David, what did Mike mean when you talk about the fabric of the last dynasty in baseball with those Yankee championship seasons of the 90s?
Well, I think people talk about the pivot, you know, from Buck Showalter, you know, Mike's Borzy's referring to, you know, that dramatic loss in 95 before Borzy was there, before Joe Torre was there, and that dramatic turn. And, I'm happy to see Buck Showalter get another chance again in New York with the Mets on that side of town, because, you know, whether it was right or wrong, whatever happened in that series, he was fired and Joe Torre was brought in, and Joe was the perfect guy at the perfect time. You know, it just worked. He dealt with George Steinbrenner so well. You know, Mike knows Joe Torre very well, spent a lot of time with him, and Joe's his godfather. He's the godson of Joe Torre. So, you know, Borzy knows what I'm talking about there, that there was a calmness, a steadiness about Joe Torre that was Johnny on the spot. It is exactly what we needed at that point, and that's what ushered in that mini dynasty we had there, 4 out of 5 years. And, you know, Borzy's got 4 of those rings. I got 4 of those rings. So that's something I think that we, you know, even though you talk about the 90s being a little bit ancient nowadays compared to the game and what's going on. And that's why I love having Borzy on, because he's the bridge guy for me. He's going to explain what it was like beforehand and what it was like all the way through the Cubs championship season and the, you know, the changes in the preparation for the game, the game planning, the technology, everything that goes into it. But Joe Torre was the right guy at the right time back in 1996.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of ground to cover, because Mike was there for all the championships. Like you said, he was there for Joe's entire time in New York, then went to LA with him. And then for a decade, saw the Cubs go from a last place team to world champions, and was there all the way up until 2021. So there's a lot of ground to cover here, but Mike, I want to start off with a couple of questions, I guess, with your time with the Yankees, because from what anyone could read about you, you're kind of described as maybe the Forrest Gump of baseball over the last 30 years or so. You're kind of always on the edge of the picture. That was a phrase that I read about you, but there are stories that you were the catcher for Mariano Rivera when he was in the bullpen discovering his cutter. What happened there with the greatest closer of all time?
So this story I've probably told 1,000 times, but it's all accidental. The cutter showed up by the grace of God. We were in Detroit, and, you know, we're going back now. People don't remember Mariano was kind of a failed starter, right? And had a 4-seam average at best slider, bad changeup mix. That was who he was. And, you know, he had that great series in 95, Coney talked about, versus Seattle, and kind of put himself on the map. And then the following year, I showed up and he was a reliever and still unheralded. Nobody really knew him. And it was basically four seam and an occasional slider for show, like not really in the zone, and then back to the four seamer. But he could dot his four seamer. He could elevate it. So, I mean, the command of it made it like he had four different fastballs just because he could put it where he wanted. And then we went to, we went through that whole year, 96, he was that way, 97 as the closer. He took over for Wetland, he was that way. And then we were in Detroit and he's warming up in the old Detroit stadium, we're on the field and he starts warming up, and I've caught Mo 100 times at this point, and he lets one go and it cuts at the end, you know, like a foot. And I'm like, I think the ball's scuffed. He looks at me. He's never thrown a cutter before. At the time, I don't even think that was a pitch, to be honest with you. I think that pitch has been created since Mariano threw it. And I remember he couldn't straighten the ball out. We're trying to straighten it out, to be honest with you. He couldn't command it. So he said, you know, whatever, and he went in the game, wound up saving the game. And after, he was in a panic about not being able to throw the ball where he wanted, because the movement was now, you know, he'd never dealt with it before. So the next day we went out with Mel Stottlemyre, our old pitching coach, and we were trying to literally straighten out this fastball he's throwing that had late cut, and we couldn't do it. And the rest is history. I mean, he learned how to command it, to use it to all four quadrants, to blow up bats, left-handed bats like no one's ever seen. I mean, but it all happened one day in Detroit, and we never looked back. But I remember we tried to fix that pitch and get back to what it was prior to.
Just remarkable, you know, it really is. I mean, you know, you've caught so many pitchers over the years, Borzy, and then, you know, you evolved. I mean, you were more than a bullpen catcher. You became sort of you were always kind of a coach. You were somebody I went to back in the 90s to talk about strategy before the game. You were somebody that a lot of the hitters talked to over the years, and I know that evolved in your job title. Now we have all sorts of coaches and job titles. You almost create a new one every year.
Right.
But you always were a strategic type of a coach, and I know that that's kind of evolved for you through the tour years. Can you just, you know, take us back? I know, you know, just a little bit of your beginning. Now you're a minor league player with the Cardinals, came out, Torrey got you to the Yankees, went to the Dodgers there, and then the Cubs. Can you tell us a little bit about your personal history, your story along the way?
Yeah, I mean, I played in the minor leagues. I knew I wasn't going anywhere. I could catch. I couldn't hit, and I knew that from the start, but I knew I wanted to be in the game. I loved the game. It's all I ever knew. My dad basically force-fed baseball on me since I was born. So
Bat Boy too, right? Braves? Bat Boy?
Yeah.
Bat Way back.
Boy, yeah, for one of the greatest brawls in the history of baseball, yeah. If you've ever seen it, versus the Padres.
Yes.
I was there.
Yeah.
Back to the Forrest Gump reference. But – I stalled out, which was fine, and I wanted to stay in the game. And I actually was done. There was no job for me. And Joe Torre got the job with the Yankees, and he never had called me or anything to ask me if I wanted to stay in the game. At that point, I thought, you know what, I'm going to do something else. And then I got a call from Bob Watson, who was the GM at the time. And apparently you guys had, in the middle of spring training, fired a bullpen catcher. Someone was let go, and it had, you know, now they were scrambling to find somebody to do this job. So Joe said to Bob Watson, well, I have Mike Borzello, if you want to call him. I don't know if he'll be interested or not. And he called me, and I came down. I had to pay my own way. Bob Watson said, listen, it's kind of a tryout. This was a reference, and we'll see how it goes. I can't promise you anything. And I wound up coming, and it all worked out. They had me catch and throw BP and hit fungos and all that stuff. And Mark Newman, the old, the minor league coordinator for the Yankees, and Gary Tuck, they were the ones kind of deciding if I stay or go. They voted yes. So that was it. That's how I got the job. That's how it all started. Then once I was there, Coney, it was like, you know, you're in awe at first because of all of you guys. It's kind of like this backstage pass that you have. So, you know, back then you kept quiet. It's different than today's game. I didn't say much. So I just sat in my locker. If you needed to go throw or throw a side or whatever, or go watch high eight video, which is what we had at the time, I'm there. I was always there and available, but I didn't speak really. And then as you become more comfortable and you guys start asking questions like in a side or after a game, or, you know, start to question yourself and you just kind of lean in on me because I'm with you all the time, then you start to realize you have a place, you know, in the game or on the team that you matter other than just catching the ball and throwing it back, you know? And that's how it really evolved and started. It was kind of finding my way that way, but doing it, you know, strategically, kind of staying out of the way, you know, when you have that low man on the totem pole position. You don't want to get in anybody's way. You want to learn how it works. And that was how it started. And then, yeah, catching you and Rocket and Boomer, and just learning by osmosis, being with Mel Stottlemyre. I mean, my goal was to gather as much information and learn from you guys. And each guy taught me a different thing, you know, like, you taught me just about, like, the number one thing I learned from you was how to manage a game as a pitcher. Like, how to strategically decide who you're pitching to. I don't have to pitch to this guy. I can work around him. I know where the outs are in the lineup. So I learned by watching you, I learned that. El Duque, watching, he taught me a lot about sequencing and how to put pitches together. And we would sit and talk about it all the time. He loved to talk pitching. And he was a master, you know, he had everything. He could do everything with the ball. And then Mike Mussina and Boomer, like Moose taught me like a plan B, like when you don't have your stuff, you know, what do you do? How do you react as a pitcher? Do we stay with the plan we went with that I can't execute today? Or do we go plan B, go another direction and find a way? Boomer, same thing. I remember Boomer warming up at times. He didn't have his curveball. And, you know, Boomer, he'd go, fuck it, let's go. And he'd go fastball changeup that day and a cutter. Just make it up, you know? Yeah, I mean, that's how my career started, was with you guys, you know? And Mel Stottlemyre, I give him so much credit. He allowed me to be a part of it. Really, you know, that's not always the case.
Right. Well, you know, we saw your career really evolve as you went with Torrey to the Dodgers. And, you know, at this point, the technology is starting to come into the game. Right. I mean, you what you're referring to in the 90s was just the old written scouting reports from advanced scouts. And you didn't know, you know, how much credence to put in some of those reports. And that's not being demeaning to the scouts at the time, but there was only so much you could glean out of some of those written reports. And now here you are, and, you know, you're with the Dodgers, you're seeing some of the technology come into the game. This is pre-Cubs years. And can you, just in your words, can you tell me the changes you've seen in the preparation before the games, the advancement of technology, and how that has changed the modern pitcher nowadays?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was with the Yankees, like I said, remember we had high eight tapes and the video guy, Charlie Wants, would like splice them together so you guys could watch a hitter every at bat he had, but it was like archaic, you know, it's hard to do. A lot of guys said, screw it, I'm not, whatever, I'll do my own thing. It just was a pain in the ass. And then when I left and went to the Dodgers, the bat system, the advent of databases started coming into play. And there was the bat system, which was basically for people that don't know, this system that had everything that happens in a baseball game is logged into this system and you can access it. So if there's a hitter, I want to look up Joey Votto. I can look up every pitch he's ever seen versus right versus left and click on it and watch the video. It was groundbreaking. Like, but a lot of people weren't using it. It was there, it was accessible, but players were never really introduced to it. So they didn't know how to use it. So that's where I kind of went. I went and learned how to bounce around on that. And lucky enough, when I got to the Dodgers, Brad Ausmus wound up coming to the Dodgers to be the backup catcher. And Brad, as you know, was longtime catcher with the Astros, very smart, cerebral catcher. And he kind of introduced me to his system of game planning and scouting reports. And he showed me how he does it and how he puts it into layman's terms or baseball terms for everyone to understand. And I basically hijacked his system when I was there and took it, you know, to another level, kind of like what the advent of information just kept getting better and better and better. So it made it, and you could work quicker and quicker. And you can put together game plans and scouting reports a lot faster. And that's how it all started. It was Brad Ausmus for me that really got me to understand how all this information works, how to bring it together, like, and present it. You have to be able to present information. If you could have all the information you want, if you're not able to present it to someone and get them to understand it, it becomes worthless. So that's where it started. With the Dodgers in 2009 or 10, I don't, whatever year it was. And it, you know, the information, as you said, Coney, it keeps getting more accessible. And we're teaching pitchers differently. Everything is done completely different than it was in the 90s. A lot of it's really, really good. Some of it is maybe not so good. I mean, maybe we've gone too far at times, but I mean, there's with information, it's all about presentation. And again, at first, when I started first doing scouting reports and game planning, even pitchers were kind of pushing you back, like, I'm just going to do what I do, you know? And you're like, well, I get it, but I'm telling you, this stuff can help you. It's going to help you if you know the hitter you're facing. It's going to help you if you know his strengths, his weaknesses, what he's trying to do, his approach. It's going to benefit you. But it was a hard sell on a lot of guys, especially early on.
Mike, can you give us an example on how to simplify a piece of pitching information and present it to a pitcher?
Oh, yeah. So a game plan or scouting report would take probably 6 or 7 hours to put together for a series. I'll start with that. It's you're dissecting every single hitter, and the stuff I did was count specific. You're looking at trying to figure out this guy's approach, if he has one. Some guys don't. Some guys just stay out of a specific swing path and you'll be fine. You know, other guys have an approach. The really good hitters in the league have a plan of what they're trying to do, where they're looking, what they're trying to swing at, what they're not swinging at. So you can break all that down and figure out who this hitter is and where the danger zones are and how to attack this guy. But you have to now condense all that information to be able to present it not only to a pitcher, but your entire staff. So your entire staff has to understand your language. And you're talking about all different walks of life that's, you know, are on a staff usually that speak all different languages that may not understand the verbiage or the lingo. So my goal was to always get everyone in the room to understand what I was trying to present. Because like I said, if you're not reaching people with the information, your information is irrelevant. So, you know, I have to be able to get the Spanish speaking guys to understand what I'm saying, as well as Yu Darvish, who I've had. Like, it's challenging, but the one thing you learn is everyone speaks the language of baseball in some form. So they understand in time what you're trying to say, but you condense all this information, you put it together, and you show it to guys, and then they kind of sort through it and figure out how it specifically applies to them. That's the best way I can put it.
Does that get more difficult in the last few years as pitching staffs have exploded? Now, it used to be a big deal when you had an 11 or 12 man pitching staff. Now it's 13 and 14. Plus you're getting more guys shuttling up and down between the minor leagues. Is it harder to kind of get everyone on the same page in that way?
At times, because you have, every time a kid comes up, you know, or someone comes from another team, you have to introduce them to your system. Cause I assuming that the system was different elsewhere, you know, everyone does things differently. So that can be challenging for sure. But you know, half the staff, you know, there's a difference. There's in baseball, there's still starters and relievers, right? So you have starters that usually have a four pitch mix, maybe five, that are looking to get hitters out multiple times, right? So they're going to hopefully face a guy three times, and they may need to get that guy out three different ways. Relievers are usually plus stuff, two pitch, max effort guys that are going to lean more on their strengths than they are a scouting report. They should know the information, but when in doubt, most of them are two pitch guys that are coming out for one look on a hitter, and it's me versus you. And I might be going, my strength versus you is the same as your strength as a hitter, but I don't care, you know? So, you know, there's two different types of pitchers. So scouting reports and game plans apply to people differently based on who you are, you know? A starter, like I said, may show you something the first at bat, and the next at bat you're seeing a completely different mix. You know, and with a reliever, you know, if they can look at a scouting report and know at least where the damage is, the guy that's going to, where is this guy going to hurt me? If I throw a ball in a specific spot, where is that where he's going to do damage? I got to stay out of there. That might be all they need to know. You know what I mean? Other than that, they're coming at you with their four seam put away slider. I mean, that's what the game really has become. I mean, just a bunch of power arms that are full throttle coming at you. And that's great. You know, it's great for one look. But you know, then you have to deal with starters who are, you know, I still believe starters that have a full mix should be able to get through a lineup three times.
That kind of brings us to the Cub years. You know, you lasted, it seems like you were really well prepared to go to the Cubs, you know, your Yankee experience and then the Dodger experience. And now all of a sudden you're going to outlast five managers with the Cubs. You had a long run there, and in advanced technology, obviously a front office that embraced it. A lot of great pitchers there, a World Series championship there. Pretty remarkable. Broke the curse of the Billy Goat. Like, tell us about the Cubs. What was different about the Cubs? I know John Lester, we had on last week, talked about you and him banging heads at first a little bit, and then he finally opened up and listened to you as a veteran pitcher who needed to make adjustments but was stubborn. You know, what was that whole philosophy with the Cubs and their program like there?
I think Theo Epstein is the guy that made you buy in and believe in this mission we were all going on. From the day I got there, I mean, it was impressive to see this guy that I had heard of with Boston and you know, the all the sabermetrics or whatever data that this guy was all into. But it wasn't about that. It was more about his leadership ability. I mean, he makes everybody feel important. And he had a line that he said one time that culminates like my entire time there was like, he said, if everyone in this room, and we had the entire organization from minor leagues all the way up, coaches, scouts, everyone, if everyone is the best at doing their job and better than the other 29 teams, whatever it is your job is, if you're the best one at it, we're going to get where we want to go. And I thought, wow, okay. So now, no matter what job you have, you felt like, okay, I'm a piece to this and I can't let the rest of these people down in this room. We're all one and we're on a mission to try and win a championship here. That was how it all started for me. And I was, you know, you wanted to run through a wall. You wanted to do everything because Theo got you fired up and made everyone accountable. He wanted your opinion. He's really good at gathering information, but gathering opinions, he's not offended if you don't agree with him. He wants to hear why you don't. And he processes. And then ultimately, of course, he makes the decision, but he doesn't want you to agree with him just because he's the president, you know? And I always thought that was special. That's not always the case either. So he likes to argue. He wants to battle you. He wants to hear why. So that was the start. And then when I got there again, it was still premature to all the information we have now. I mean, believe it or not, that was 2012 and we were still all working off the bat system. And then Theo decided, you know what? I'm going to hire people to build our own database. And I don't know where he found them, but he went to the Ivy League and found a bunch of guys that created this incredible database, and they called it Ivy. And you talk about taking it to another level. Like, this had everything. Bats was great, but this was like bats on steroids. And anything you wanted added or changed, they wanted feedback. They wanted to know, like, how does this make sense? Everything was in there. I mean, no matter what you wanted to look up, defense, at-bats, pitching, mechanical change, everything was on there. And at that time, that was groundbreaking. No one really had that. Your own in-house database that had everything. And it made it really easy for guys like me to navigate through and gather information at such a faster rate. And I mean, that was another huge moment, like where the information is now accessible to the entire organization. So everyone's a part of it. Before, you know, I'm working on the bat system, but no one else is, you know, a couple of players may look at it, but not really. This now invited everybody into the room, because everyone had access to Ivy. And that's how it all started with the Cubs. And then, yeah, I mean, they went out and got the right mix, the right players. And my system was in place even through the couple losing years we had. The system was being put in place from 2012, 13, and 14 until 15, which is when we knew we were good. We knew guys, the minor league guys, you know, Chris Bryant and Hobby and Addison Russell and Schwarber were all starting to arrive at the same time. And we signed John Lester, you know, I mean, and David Ross coming with him, you know, his leadership ability. So, I mean, it seems like it happened so fast. We got good faster than we thought, to be honest. 15, we were early to the dance, I think. We impressed people, John was great. We beat the Cardinals in the playoffs, a team that had just annihilated us for years. And that was kind of our World Series that year, beating the Cardinals. And then we lost to the Mets. They killed us four straight and we were out. But we knew we were ready. And the following year, you saw, 2016. Unbelievable.
That had to be incredible, that feeling. You're seeing grown men crying in the stands at Wrigley. When that happened, championships. You felt it with the 96 Yankees, surely. But that one, wow. It's generational. That had all the feels, rather, I'm sure, for anybody involved.
Yeah, I was happy that I was there from 12, 13, 14, 15, and then there for 16, because I got to appreciate, the Cub fan, the losing, because we did lose 100 games, I think, in 12 and 13. So I was part of that, the lovable loser, type of thing that goes on at Wrigley. Fans still come out. They still have a good time. But when we won, seeing people going to their grandfather's gravesite or mother's gravesite and putting the Cubs banner or listening to the game with their deceased family member. How do you even describe that? How deep rooted this passion is. And 108 years, that it took to get one, and all the heartbreak along the way. It wasn't just that you didn't win one. They were so close to, so many times, and it just didn't work out. But when we beat the, and it still gets me going, like beating the Indians in that dramatic game seven. I don't know how to describe it.
How did you handle the pressure? You have an ascendant team in 2015, 2016, you steamroll most of the league and you go on this playoff run. Coney, you've talked about the pressure in 98, where a record setting team, you have the number one team in baseball all through the year. And then you feel like you have to cash it in or else it all goes out the window. Was it something similar like that in 2016 when you had absolutely the best team in baseball, but you had to make sure you still brought it home in what can really be a random short series?
Right. Yeah, there's definitely relief at the end of winning that championship because, not that you pay attention to the curse or things like that, but still in the back of your mind a little that, things always seem to go wrong. And we did have the best team, but we were still really young. So, we had a lot of position players that still were a little raw and, still growing up as players. The lucky part was our pitching staff was built on veteran starters and they were able to handle the moments, because you're always going to go through some bad moments in the postseason. And it's how you react to them because they're inevitable. And when you lack experience, you usually let those moments get the best of you. When you have pitchers like Lester, John Lackey, Jake Arrieta, guys like that, who can handle the moment, that I think was the key to us winning that championship. Those guys... Our pitching staff, I don't think one of our starters missed a start that year, which is unheard of too. I'm pretty sure that's true. If it's not, it's close. So you have our five-man rotation going out there every day. And they were the reason I think that we were able to pull it off. Even in game seven, you saw we went Kyle Hendricks, started it, and John Lester came in relief. Arrieta and Lackey were out in the bullpen and declared themselves available too. Jake had just pitched the day before, six innings. So I think that was the key to that year, the veteran leadership of our our starting rotation, and David Ross and Miguel Montero, guys like that, that were able to keep calm, you know, in the toughest moments when, you know, sometimes our younger core could get overwhelmed, you know? So I think that was the key to the whole thing and how it all worked. And of course, Joe Maddon was the perfect manager for that whole thing, you know, just his whole demeanor.
You mentioned the continuity with the starting staff. So here's the 2016 team. John Lester, 32 starts. Arrieta, 31 starts. 30 apiece from Kyle Hendricks and Jason Hamill, 29 from Lackey. So those guys really were the bedrock on that pitching staff.
I mean, and you know what's weird about that is I don't even know the average innings per start for our rotation, but I feel like it's over six innings, where in today's game, you're not seeing that anymore. There, you know, it's built from back to front a lot. So the bullpen is called on a lot more. And this is only what, 5-6 years later, that how much the game has changed. Coney keeps talking about the game changing. That's certainly something that has changed. We were leaning on our starters. Our starters were our guys, you know, and we did have a good bullpen, but we didn't overuse them, which made them effective when necessary. So we had Pedro Strop and Hector Rondon and Aroldis Chapman. We traded for, you know, with the Yankees, we got him for Gleyber Torres. So we had a good bullpen, but we leaned on our starters. They were capable. None of those guys wanted to come out of a game. You know, they're not conditioned to be that way anymore. That was kind of the end of an era. You know, pitchers know now that two times through the order is the thing, and they'll hand the ball over because they know that's the strategy and that's the theory. Back then, you had to wrestle a ball away from John Lackey. I mean, you're going to fight him if you try to take him out just because he's gone two times through the order. John Lester the same way. So, you know, it might have been the end of that style of baseball where, you know, you went heavy starter and limited your relievers to hopefully only having to pitch two innings.
Like, you've self-described yourself as being the low man on the totem pole with the Yankees, all the way through to being an instrumental part in preparing a team for individual series. So you have gradually built up a fantastic coaching career. What do you want to do next?
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question. You never get tired of winning, so anytime there's an opportunity to be part of a team in some capacity that has a chance to win, I mean, I'm all for that. Kind of a jack of all trades. I can kind of adapt to whatever's necessary, but it's always been about winning. So, you know, Coney talked about the rings, and lucky to have been a part of five championship teams and gone to seven World Series, and I don't know. I want a sixth championship as much as I wanted to be part of the first one. So I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. But being a part of a winner in some capacity, you know, that would be it. The job title, you know, is not really relevant. It's more about being with a group that has a chance to do something special. And because every time that happens, it's euphoric. There's no way to describe it, you know? That's it. Yeah, I guess be part of another winner.
I love it. You know, we always have this feature, I guess, at the end of every interview with a guest where we give you a chance to ask something to an upcoming guest of the podcast. But first, we're, you know, going to have a question that someone posed to you. And now's the time that we're going to relay that to you. So we have a question for you before you have a question for an upcoming guest. And this comes from a young pitcher who has the potential of being an important piece of the Yankees pitching staff this season. It's right-hander Michael King. We kind of prefaced it saying, hey, bullpen catchers pretty much know everything that's going on with the pitching staff. And that sort of just triggered him. So here's what Michael King had for you, Mike.
So this is something that has ran through my mind a ton. There are so many different routines of relievers, especially. Obviously Chapman as a ninth inning guy will come out in the sixth or seventh inning and he does a ton of stuff inside. And then when he comes out, he doesn't have to do as much. So he does a little bit of a warm up and then he throws his weighted ball. But there are all the guys that are there in the bullpen the whole game. Some of them sit for 7-8 innings, whatever it is, and then go out there and can still throw 100 miles an hour. Some of them are moving the whole time. I would love to know the elite relievers that he's caught, what their routines are, because I almost have a theory of relievers that are in the league for 10 plus years, whatever, they get a ton of time, are one of the more most active people in the bullpen. So I would love to know if there were any a Mariano or an elite reliever that just sat there the whole time. And in the bullpen, we talk about that a ton. So-and-so has sat for 6 innings straight now. He hasn't even stood up to pee yet. And then all of a sudden he gets called. And I kind of took Chad Green's philosophy or routine of getting up in the second and third inning, getting up in the fifth inning, getting up in the seventh inning again. And I want to know if there are elite relievers that are able to just sit there the whole time.
I haven't experienced that. The elite relievers for me have a routine. I'll use Mariano as the example for the 12 years I was with him. Mariano would come out after the fifth inning and he had already got his massage or whatever. And one thing about Mo is he watched the game inside, so he knew everything that was going on. He'd come out after the fifth, he'd sit down next to me. We'd watch an inning of the game. And then he would get up and start stretching. So after the sixth inning, he's stretching. He's got his weighted ball. He did the same routine every day. Once he was done with that, and the seventh inning came around, he was lathered up and ready. As we know, Mariano had a lot of 2-inning saves. So he had to be ready at, a moment's notice. And Joe Torre, in 96 especially, would summon Mo before he was even a closer at any time. There was no role, so Mo had to be ready and on call. But no, I have not seen elite relievers that don't have some sort of routine that incorporates moving around or doing something and just sitting there. I'm sure they exist, but I haven't crossed paths with them. No.
No secret sauce. Just no. Excellence.
They're mostly, there's a routine of some sort from all the great ones I've been around.
Yeah. All right. Here's a name of an upcoming guest that you're going to be able to ask a question to. It is the consensus top pitching prospect in the game right now, right-hander Grayson Rodriguez of the Baltimore Orioles. What would you ask someone that kind of has that much hype and is pretty close to reaching the big leagues here?
Ooh, what would I ask him? I would say, I'd have a lot of things to tell him. What would I ask him? What is his main goal going forward as a pitcher? Is it personal success? Is it winning? Is it money? Is it all of it? What motivates him? And everyone's different. Everyone's going to give you the stock line. I want to win. But for everyone, it's a different answer. So what makes this guy wake up in the morning and bust his ass and work hard? What is the number one thing that he focuses on? That's what I would ask him. And how old is he?
I believe he's 24.
Okay.
Let me fact check that really quick.
He's 22.
22? Okay.
Thought provoking, you know, really is.
I mean, yeah, it's everyone has a different thing that they're chasing. So it's,
you know, there's nothing wrong with saying, you know, for me, one of the best days of my career is when I won my first arbitration case and I made over $1 million. That was a big deal because I could retire my father from the graveyard shift at the meatpacking plant. So there's nothing wrong with that. Right. Nothing wrong with having that as a motivating factor. That was one of the greatest days. That call I had to my dad, shut it down. I got you. I got your back. That was the best ever.
Exactly. And plus, if you achieve some sort of financial stability, it now can allow you to relax and take your focus on other things, which can be, I can relax more. I can, now it's all about winning, you know, everyone's different, but yeah, I don't think there's any shame in saying, you know, I'm trying to make a living here.
Trying to take care of my family. Yeah,
that's right. So I don't know. That's my question.
I like it.
Yeah. Something that not a lot of people talk about in professional sports with athletes. Feels like it's always black and white. It's really not. So that's terrific. We're looking forward to asking Grayson that, especially a guy who's really close to reaching the majors. Mike, this was so much fun reflecting back, looking ahead, going into the weeds with game prep. We're eating it up here. So thanks for your time.
Yeah, anytime.
Great job, Borzy, man. Wish you well in the future, man. You deserve a job somewhere. You can still help a lot of organizations. Maybe broadcasting. Who knows? You know,
maybe put in a word for me there at ESPN.
Yeah, there you go.
All right. Thanks, guys.
David, I'm going to go all the way back to the beginning of this because he gave a pretty interesting memory of you getting up in front of the team and delivering a pretty powerful speech. Do you remember the exact context of that pep talk, so to speak? What was it? What was the nature of that?
I think the nature of that particular team meeting was that we were off to a very slow start, even though it was only the first week of the season. George Steinbrenner was still fully in control of that team. And we felt like, and we had heard whispers that changes could be coming if we don't turn it around in a hurry, and jobs were on the line. And so that was just kind of a meeting where it was a classic Joe Torre meeting where he went around the room and allowed anybody to speak, or almost challenged guys to speak, you know, hey, O'Neill, you got something to say, you know, on down the road, Andy Pettit, do you have something to say? And so when it got to me, I had something to say, and, you know, I did my best to emphasize, you know, what I knew about the New York market, having played in New York the majority of my career, both with the Mets and the Yankees. I knew the drumbeat when the media starts to get on a story, and there was already talk about who would be Joe Torre's successor at that point. And that's when I put it on the line. Hey, you know, we're playing for each other. Jobs are on the line here. We all know who our owner is, you know, and if we don't turn this around, changes are going to be made, and who knows what direction we'll go from that point on. So yeah, sometimes those meetings are overrated, and we went out and won a game that night and went on a roll after that. So this goes down to, how do you quantify clubhouse chemistry? What does an internal meeting really mean? It's the human element that's just so hard to put a number on. And people remember that. And, you know, maybe it was motivational for a lot of guys. Maybe it crystallized things. Maybe it brought us together. But I'd like to think that it was, you know, it was impactful. But, you know, who knows, really? How do you really put your finger on something like that?
We asked Mike at the end what he'd like to do next in baseball. I think he was kind of modest in his answer there. You know him pretty well, though. Do you think he has aspirations of managing one day?
I think he has a tremendous skill set. You know, he is, you know, we talk about analytics and understanding analytics, and he certainly continued his education throughout the years and was at the forefront of learning some of the new systems and the development of these internal systems, these databases that are proprietary information and data that each team is developing nowadays. And he has been on the forefront of those. So his skill set is tremendous in terms of understanding that part of the game. But to me, the even stronger skill set he has is the interpretation of that data, because he was a minor league catcher. He was a professional ball player. He worked his way up through the ranks. He was a low man on the totem pole. Like he said, kind of keep your mouth shut and you catch your bullpens. And if somebody speaks to you or asks you your opinion, then maybe you pipe up. But what a development process he had and he learned how to interpret those things. And to me, that's the most important thing you can have in an organization nowadays. And obviously they have very strong skill sets in the front offices nowadays in terms of biomechanics or sabermetrics or analytics, any subset of analytics you want. But how do you get that information to the players, and how do you interpret it? How do you analyze it? How do you put it into the terms that players understand? And that's the strength of Mike Borzello. That's what I say. He has that skill set of understanding the analytics, but understanding the player side as well, and being able to bridge the gap between the two and interpret that knowledge and that information.
It's such a valuable role in the game today, that liaison between the clubhouse and the research and development department. I think clubs are on a never-ending search to find that perfect voice for those roles to kind of bridge those two departments for sure. All right, James, this week in pitching history, what do you have for us?
All right, two things. One good, one not so good. March 22nd, 2017, 5 years ago, Tuesday, Team USA wins the World Baseball Classic. Marcus Stroman takes a no-hitter into the seventh, finishing with six innings of one-hit shutout ball, and the U.S. beats Puerto Rico 8-0 at Dodger Stadium. It was the first time the U.S. won it. Japan won the first two in 2006 and 2009. The Dominican Republic won in 2013. USA in 2017. It was canceled due to COVID in 2021, but it's scheduled to return in 2023. I love the WBC. Transitioning to something not so great. March 25th, 2001, 21 years ago Friday, Randy Johnson kills a bird with a pitch in a spring training game. The unluckiest dove who ever doved. Just an explosion of feathers, just very unfortunate, and really a one in a billion shot. It was ruled a no pitch, by the way.
I didn't know that last part. You see that all the time on YouTube. I think in a less sensitive time, probably on blooper reels. I don't think it makes the rounds there anymore. But as far as the World Baseball Classic, I am with you, James. I love it. It has like that October feel, that October suspense, because there's something on the line and it's coming. It's happening in March. I can't beat that. That was the Adam Jones grab at the wall, right?
It was earlier in that tournament. Same tournament. Yeah.
Yeah. You a big fan of the WBC, David?
Oh, yes. I mean, I was part of the Players Association when we talked about these sorts of things, how great it would be. Nobody could predict who would win. You know, Venezuela would have a great team. The Dominican Republic would have a great team. Japan would have a great team. So, yeah, on down the list, it really is. Baseball, more than any other sport, encompasses so many different countries. You know, even though if you're not a big baseball fan, maybe you're not aware of that to a certain extent. But the thing I also noticed, too, is the genuine emotion from a lot of the players. When you watch the Dominican Republic team, when they won a couple of years ago or a few series ago, that genuine emotion kind of changed the way we looked at the game. You know, that authentic emotion is okay to show. You know, the old school, don't show up your opponent or don't bat flip or don't do this or don't do that. Repress your emotions. I think the World Baseball Classic has been a big driver of allowing and showing and educating authentic emotion is good for the game. It grows the game. People want to see that. The younger generation definitely wants to see that. And the old school notion of no, you can't do that. WBC has been instrumental in changing a lot of people's minds in that regard.
I think it also showcased that a country like or territory like the Netherlands with Curaçao and all the talent that a squad like that has, because before the WBC, you had an idea of the Andrew Joneses and players like that, but I think the World Baseball Classic put them on the main stage, the platform to show how much talent they are producing in Curaçao and with the Netherlands and that representation. All right, three up, three down here, guys. And look, once the regular season starts, we're changing three up, three down. That's been the plan this entire time. So these are the last couple of weeks of three up, three down as we know it. Once the season gets rolling, we're going to focus on a pitcher. Each of us are going to give a pitcher who we think these listeners should focus in on more and keep an eye out for. So right now, it's still the status quo, so to speak. Pick up a topic that we kind of want to shed some light on. So, David, how about you lead us off here?
You know, I think it's interesting, even though a lot of the you know, and this is just coming, I'm just thinking of this right now, so I'm going to throw it on you guys. The rules changes that aren't happening yet, but are going to happen. You know, I even saw something on the MLB Network where Mike Zunino was using an earpiece already, and he could, you know, we're already going to the catcher's signals and really trying to speed up the game in that regard. And he had kind of favorable reviews of it. He's got a wristband. He can buzz the pitch right to the pitcher. There's no signs, especially with men on base. He said it was a noticeable increase in the pace of play, along with a pitcher's clock, you know, a hitter's clock. I'd rather call it the hitter's clock rather than the pitcher's clock, but I'm biased. The bigger bases, the infielders, and the banning of the shift is going to come. So all the, you know, I'm trying to think about how the impact collectively of all these rules together and which ones will actually have the most impact. I really do believe now that the crispness of the game, the pace of play, can really be impacted by some of these rules collectively together. And it's going to be interesting to follow some of these experiments in the minor leagues, and not to mention, not the least of which is robo umps. Whether you like it or not, it's coming. I don't know exactly when it's going to be implemented, but it's coming. So, you know, get ready.
Well, the time to do it is in the minor leagues. You know, put your foot in the pool, see how it goes. It's a low stakes environment to test things out and see what sticks and what doesn't.
I saw the news of what Zunino was doing and the contraptions that the Rays were using. Do you think other teams are going to be using that stuff during exhibition play, or is this just the Rays kind of being out in front of everything?
I think there was at least one other team that they mentioned in that report on the MLB Network that was experimenting with it this spring as well, to see, you know, to kind of work through the kinks and see how, you know, how it came through. Now Zunino's a veteran catcher, so yeah, he has credibility, and he had pretty positive reviews on it in terms of, let's go get in the box, swing the bat. And in particular with men on base, we've seen that's when the game really tends to slow down. It naturally slows down anyway, if you've got a running threat, you know, a stolen base threat or pickoff moves or things like that. But with a man on second base and recent history with all the espionage going on and sign stealing and gamesmanship, or what's gamesmanship and what's technologically, you know, espionage, so to speak. So yeah, maybe that's an answer. That's when the game really slows down. You get multiple signs, infielders are moving around, catcher doesn't put down the right sign, the pitcher shakes him off. That really slows down the game. Now we got to go through a whole nother sequence of signs. And yeah, that's interesting to me to attack that part of the game and see if it really does help. And if it helps the crispness and the overall pace of play, then, you know, I'm kind of for it at this point.
All right, James, what do you have? Three up, three down.
The Braves signing Kenley Jansen, a mainstay of the Dodgers during their run in the 2010s and early 2020s, 350 career saves, and now he's going to Atlanta. It'll be weird to see him in a different uniform, but the Braves bullpen is going to be absolutely loaded. They were such a big part of their championship run in October, and now just running down the list, Kenley Jansen, Will Smith, Tyler Matzek, our old pal AJ Minter, Luke Jackson, and they also added Colin McHugh, who I think is a fantastic pickup as well. You put their top six up against pretty much any of the other top six relievers on the depth chart against any team, the Braves are going to be formidable late in the game.
Loaded pen, couldn't agree more. I thought Colin McHugh was arguably one of the biggest steals of the offseason to whatever team he went to. And he ends up going to Atlanta. And look, the NL East, despite the Mets making huge moves, that division is going to be tight, in my opinion, between the Mets' big moves. They're changing leadership with Buck now in the manager spot. But the Braves offsetting Freddie Freeman's departure with Matt Olson's addition, adding to the bullpen. And then the Phillies, feels like they're just going to slug their way to the postseason. They made some additions to their bullpen, but here we go with an expanded postseason. They could probably hit their way into October.
It's a great point, and it just shows you the pressure a lot of these organizations are under on keeping up with the Joneses, so to speak. If you're the Philadelphia Phillies and you know you got to contend with the Braves, and what James just said about their incredible bullpen, you got a tough division, you got the Mets, you got a new sheriff in town on the ownership side, and Steve Cohen, he actually has his own tax threshold named after him already. So yeah, if you're the Phillies, what are you going to do? Well, you got to catch up. You got to make some hay. And then they're going to try to slug their way through it with Schwarber and Castellanos. It'd be fun to watch offensively with Bryce Harper right in the middle of that crew. And the, you know, Bryce Harper looks like a pretty good signing right now. All of a sudden, after
sure does.
All that talk, his average annual value, you know, we'll see on the back end. But wow, he's lived up to every bit of his end of the bargain. Has Bryce Harper. So yeah, they're going to be a fun offensive team to watch this year.
I mentioned Matt Olson's name. He was traded last week to Atlanta. Guys, did you hear about the curse of Trader Joe's in Arizona last week?
No.
No? Okay, so here we go.
Oh, wait. Maybe I did hear something about
this. The John Boy media crew, they were out in Arizona at the Topps Bun House. And, I mean, we set up a whole pad with a bunch of games. There is ping pong, blitz ball. There is chip and putt, cornhole, Mario Kart tournaments. And a bunch of players came by, the John Boy media crew, whether it was Trevor Plouffe, Jimmy and Jake, Chris Rose, Joe's McFly. They went out, you know, to spring training sites. Jerry Blevins was there as well. And between some of the players coming over and the crew going out to spring training sites, Joe's McFly, part of the John Boy media crew, I think he had the cursed handshake, because you take a look at the players that came over and interacted with Joe's. You had Matt Olson coming over. Matt Chapman came over. You had Amir Garrett come over. And then Joe's went out to Reds camp. He may have taken the last picture with Jesse Winker as a Cincinnati Red. Joe's poses with Winker, and maybe 15 minutes later, he's dealt over to Seattle. The other guys come over to the house, and within 24 to 36 hours, they're out of town as well. It was wild. I think the last player that came over, Taylor Trammell, the young outfielder for the Mariners, everyone was joking, hey, do you want Joe's to stay on the other side of the house? Or, you know, is there a situation that you're not happy with in Seattle? We can arrange a meet here. So a lot of players came over. The Whit Merrifields, Evan Longoria, our former guest, Josh Hader, came over. And yeah, Joe's had he had some type of power there that was going on. He had four players that he met, and they were subsequently traded within like a day. Wild stuff. So he gets the nickname Trader Joe's. And we're probably not going to see anything like that anymore because of the nature of this offseason coming out of the lockout, big moves being made in March. It was just a whirlwind of everything kind of combusting in mid-March here in the baseball world.
That just tells me too that John Boy Media, wherever they are, is the place to be. You know, yeah. You're drawing some big stars, some big names around, things are going to happen. So yeah, that's impressive that you drew in those biggest stars, you know, to wherever you set up camp out there. So yes, another notch in the John Boy Media post as they continue their ascent.
It was wild having like Amir Garrett come over. He came over with TJ Antone, another pitcher, ground ball specialist for the Reds. And I mean, they were playing ping pong late at night, and like less than 12 hours, that was like the morning talk. Yo, did you just see Amir Garrett got traded to Kansas City? He was just here. Wild stuff. But yeah, it was a good time. A lot of content still to be released from that Arizona trip. So if you missed it, you want to make sure that you keep an eye out on the John Boy media platforms for the Topps Bunt House in Arizona. Guys, that's going to do it for us here this week. We are getting closer to opening day. We cannot wait. Big thanks to Mike Borzello for coming on the show this week. Big thanks, as always, to our great producer, Dan Rourke. New episodes of the show, they drop each and every Tuesday. Please rate, review, and subscribe. It is the best way that you can show your support for the show. Tone the Slab, Pitching with David Cone, is a production of John Boy Media. We'll talk to you next week, everybody.